Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Thursday morning, the 28th of June, the sun is rising as always each morning all around our country, and that tomb is empty because Jesus has risen, and that is good news indeed for us as believers. When we begin to feel relatively hopeless in life or grief strikes us, there always is another part of the story. It doesn't mean that the grief goes away automatically. It's not a band-aid over the pain of life. It just means that there is healing and wholeness awaiting us in our future, and that is the great hope of the empty tomb. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined as always in studio by Logan Rausch running the sound and the board, and Paul Perot and Rachel Sutton. Great thanks to them for the guests that we get each day to help us navigate through the headlines of the day, not just from a news perspective, but also from our Christian perspective about what it means to be a believer in today's world. Good morning, Logan.
Good morning, Dr. Peter Kapsner.
So we wake up today, and just like yesterday, there's very little to talk about, right? I mean, very few things happening in the news.
You know what I thought least about yesterday? North Dakota. I don't know why. It just, for some reason, was furthest from my mind.
Oh, I'm sure, because that was like top of the mind for us, was it not? I mean, North Dakota, Fargo, they were ground zero of some major news events. One of our affiliates in that neck of the woods. And of course, we left the studio yesterday, and we are all set for the show today. We are going to talk about a Supreme Court decision around labor dues and the impact of that. And of course, news broke yesterday afternoon of the retirement of Kennedy in the Supreme Court and what that's going to mean. So Fargo got a front and center seat last night from President Trump's reaction to that. And we're going to talk with Ben Johnson of Acton Institute here in a couple minutes just about the rippling implications of this decision.
So there's your life lesson for the day. Don't make plans because you don't know what's coming next, and it's all going to be thrown on the floor. That's a lesson from God. God's plan, not yours.
That's outstanding, Logan. And one other headline came crashing through, too, is that one of our affiliates in Madison is a couple hours away from Mount Pleasant, a couple hour drive. But of course, the president is heading that direction today.
Going to Racine.
Yeah, indeed. And helping to open the $10 billion Foxconn plant that is going to create quite a few jobs in Wisconsin. And Logan, I'm curious, you know, you as a millennial, you hear a lot of stuff and it's tends to be generalized, but what is the job market for you? Clearly you have a job here, at least for now, at least until tomorrow, most likely.
Yeah.
And but for your fellow millennials, what does the outlook look like for you?
Well, it's so interesting because Scott Walker is actually currently on a huge marketing campaign to pull millennials into Wisconsin.
Interesting.
They've spent, I think, a few million dollars in both the Twin Cities and in Chicago running ads talking about the different benefits of working in Wisconsin. Like the average commute is 15 minutes to work and the average cost of living is so and so and so and so. So I'm getting job offers from Scott Walker. Just keep that in mind, you know, any general managers that might be listening.
We will make sure we send hourly emails. We can't lose you from the show, Logan. So if you're listening to Madison, Faith 104.7, great to have you here this morning. Same with Fargo, Faith 1200 KFNW. It's Faith Radio Mornings. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll dive more deeply into these headlines with one of our regular guests, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute.
This is my right, a right given by God.
It is 9 minutes past the hour, and in terms of walk-up music rankings, Logan, I would say that this walk-up music for one of our favorites here, Ben Johnson, has got to be right near the top of the list.
For you, maybe.
Really? This is not your kind of thing?
I don't know the song.
Oh, Ben, I'm so sorry to introduce you that way. You know, we're going to have to do some education of Logan here in the future, are we not?
Well, I guess he's as ignorant of good music as I am of the World Cup, so I think it's a one-off.
Oh, that just strikes right at the heart. You know, Ben, you do such a good job of cluing us in on the headlines of the day. I feel it's a moral obligation in Christian agape love to be able to let you know that Argentina and Brazil did make it through to the knockout round, but Germany, my motherland, my homeland, mm-hmm. the place of my ancestors, it has been knocked out of the CL. I can't even hardly breathe right now, Ben.
Well, I am also barely breathing and I can't find the air.
Well, great to have you on. You know, we were just saying before the break that you leave the studio these days and you get a nice show set up and all of a sudden news breaks. And of course, you know, top of the mind, the biggest headline from last night was the retirement of Kennedy. And now we're talking about another Supreme Court vacancy. This is number two in just the short presidency of Donald Trump. What's your reaction to this news?
Well, it's for such a time as this that this presidency has come about, apparently. When you look at the Supreme Court and the balance of the court, of course, you had the unexpected death of Antonin Scalia and then Merrick Garland put forward by President Obama. And I was so encouraged that Mitch McConnell and some of the Republicans were able to hold the line for an entire year virtually. Against tremendous odds in order to assure that the American people had a vote on the direction of the Supreme Court. And then you had Neil Gorsuch come forward. He's been a phenomenally good choice. And now Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote on the court, has announced that he's stepping down. So this is going to be truly the battle over the direction of the Supreme Court. When you looked at the decisions that came out just this past week, very good decisions. Most of them were 5-4. Kennedy is the pivot justice. And so if you're going to swing the balance into the right hand or at least the right leaning column, you could still have an occasional intellectual defection. But if Kennedy is the swing vote, this is the decisive vote that we have been waiting for. And then if you look down the road yet, of course, you still have several justices who are getting on in years, not least being the arch leftist on the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is so celebrated on the left. She's earned the nickname the notorious RBG. And then Stephen Breyer is not exactly a young man either at this point. So there's a potential for yet more, but this is going to be the decisive battle over the direction of the Supreme Court and whether it continues to be a court that's mercurial in the case of Kennedy, or if it's going to be one that is right-leaning and tends toward originalism. And if Trump holds true to the 25 people on his list, you're going to see, at a very minimum, a center-right court and the potential of another originalist judge getting through.
And Trump last night obviously referenced the idea of the rippling implications that for years, generations, actually, appointing justices could have. And to your point, I believe it was FDR, he appointed 5 Supreme Court justices. And so this could be the most amount of justices nominated and confirmed under a president for a long time. But let's listen to a clip from the president last night about the implications of how many years this could last.
And I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy. That's why he did it.
Now, I'm not entirely sure that was behind the choice of Kennedy was confidence in Trump. I mean, Kennedy certainly has voted as that swing vote over the years in different directions, both conservative and liberal. But he goes on to say in that clip that we're talking 40 to 45 years potentially is what he wants to have for the next Supreme Court justice on the court.
Yes, these rulings have rippling effects, as you mentioned, that simply go on for decades. You know, we're still living with the after effects of Roe versus Wade, which had a lot to do with, as you mentioned, the fact that FDR appointed so many of the justices who were on the courts. And if you look at that 20-year period of Democratic dominance of the executive branch from FDR and his 4 terms, the 5th with Harry Truman, and then John F. Kennedy didn't have a tremendous impact. Wizard White was sort of a center-right justice generally, but then Thurgood Marshall far to the left from LBJ. So if you look at the impact and the general drift of the court, you got the Warren Court, Warren coming from Eisenhower, Someone asked Eisenhower the biggest mistake he ever made, if he ever had any regrets or mistakes. He said, yeah, they're sitting on the Supreme Court. But you look at the fact that the 25 judges that President Trump had named as the people he would choose from, and he said he was going to hold to that list. These, for the most part, are phenomenally good judges. Most of them tend to be originalists, and they have a track record for the most part. There are a few who don't have a lot to say about some of the issues that your listeners will care about, but for the most part, they have a track record on these issues, and it's wonderful. So I think that we're going to be happy with anyone who gets nominated, provided that the Republicans can stick together in the Senate. You're going to see an historic transformation that could have consequences for the way that law is interpreted, whether the original intent of the founders is consulted, let alone allowed to carry the day, whether foreign law and laws of foreign Supreme Courts influence the way that we interpret law in the United States, something that came up during the confirmation of Elena Kagan, who believes, and Kennedy also introduced this in some of his opinions, that if foreign courts have made rulings, that should interpret the way that we look at the U.S. Constitution. Issues of that sort. Obviously, issues of life and definition of marriage and what Kennedy called the mystery of life when he was reaffirming Roe versus Wade, the idea of economic independence, the role of the federal judiciary, the role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states and the states vis-a-vis our individual rights, all of that ultimately comes up for the Supreme Court, and we can either have the will of the founders or this rotating court and dictatorship of any five people who can happen to cobble together an opinion in which they agree. So that's really what's at stake, and I think it's wonderful we have this opportunity, and down the road, one or perhaps even two more over the next 6 years.
It's going to be a fascinating next couple of months before the midterms as well, because I think the Republicans in control of the House and of the Senate are going to want to fast track the next justice through to not risk whatever happens post 2018 midterms. It's Ben Johnson with Acton Institute. Ben, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I would love for you to comment on the 28-year-old Democratic socialist out of New York who had a shocking victory in the primaries, and we'll talk about the implications of that moving forward. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. Stay with us. It's 19 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we have Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute on the line to help us walk through some of these many headlines of the day that have come out in the last 24, 48 hours. And Ben, before the break, we referenced that there was a pretty big primary upset in New York where a 28-year-old Latino Democratic Socialist, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, beat a 10-term incumbent in Joe Crowley, who was really seen to be next in line just about for the Speaker of the House and Nancy Pelosi. What was your sort of reaction to this news?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that Crowley was in the pipeline to become part of the leadership, or at least so it seemed to everyone on the outside. So this isn't someone who it happened to be a marginal seat. I've heard people say that this is a left-leaning district, which it certainly is. But this is not just someone who is leaning to the left. As you mentioned, she's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. She's endorsed Bernie Sanders' call for the federal government to guarantee that every American has a job no matter what, which means the federal government going into a massive hiring spree. And there's some races that are remarkable because they're a one-off. There are others that strike the court as though this is the shape of things to come. And this race is in that latter category for those of us who've been watching the Democratic Party. We've been expecting a sea change in the way that it's been going back at least to the year 2000. Some of us might remember in the year 2000, you had Ralph Nader run for president, and all of the excitement in the year 2000 was behind him, not Al Gore. By that point, Democrats were tired of the Clinton machine and the fact that it was seen as too centrist, too compromising, and they did not like the politics of the president, not just his personal foibles and scandals. That really has never been aired out because Barack Obama came along. It seemed as though the party had realigned, and then the Clinton machine reasserted itself with Hillary, and nobody was really too terribly interested in Hillary Clinton personally. They might have wished that she had won the election, certainly, than Donald Trump, particularly with these Supreme Court vacancies we were just talking about. But the fact of the matter is that there is no enthusiasm for anything other than the kind of politics embodied by Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. That's where the excitement and the oxygen is in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party increasingly is becoming a Democratic Socialist Party sold out to identity politics, far-left views of economics, and a radical reshaping, reimagining, in fact, the complete reformation in their view, or the destruction in our view, of the Democratic Republic and all the things which America stands for. And that's really the basis of this particular victory. It's reimagining the Democratic Party as a Democratic Socialist Party with complete open borders, complete marriage to identity politics, and then an ultra-left-wing view of economics that has to accompany identity politics. I spoke about this a little bit at Acton University last week. When you have groups or you believe that America is divided into groups that are completely impermeable and that have completely warring views of one another, that we have a zero-sum economic game and it's a war of one group against another, and since that's largely defined by identity politics, that means ethnicity, then there's going to be continual ethnic conflict and a war over those resources. And whoever happens to control the federal government and redistributes those resources has the momentary advantage. So there's continual conflict. When you have a free market, then you probably don't even know the ethnic background of the people who make the goods that you purchase on the shelves. You just know that you're grateful they're there, you purchase them, and it brings harmony about in society. And it's that view of society which we embrace versus this view of a zero-sum game and continual war that increasingly the base of the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, which is becoming the dominant voice in the Democratic Party, they are that's where they're leading this country.
Well, and it's fascinating because things do seem to be moving far more to the left on one side, far more to the right on the other. The battle lines are being drawn up a little bit. And I think even Nancy Pelosi recognized it was not easy to get somebody to run as far to the left of Pelosi as Cortez did. But here's a clip from Pelosi trying to do some damage control about where we are headed in the Democratic Party.
I want to make a plea to my Democrat friends. Please, please, please don't remove Nancy Pelosi. She should be where she is.
And so the president mentioned last night, obviously, about Pelosi, and she was out this morning basically saying this is a one-off, that this victory in New York does not represent the future of the party. But to your point, Ben, it seems like our country is moving to some real opposite polarized positions.
Yes, our country increasingly is moving in as you say, opposite directions, not merely polarizing, but opposite. This has been going on for a very long time. And you have the base of the Republican Party, which felt that it was being ignored for a very long time. It reasserted itself with the Donald Trump victory in the primaries and then in the White House. At the same time, you had a similar populist revolt within the Democratic Party, which found its support for people like Ralph Nader and Howard Dean and the MoveOn.org wing, which ultimately came to power with the triumph of Barack Obama and then following along with Bernie Sanders. But you know, what concerns me is there was a poll out the other day from Rasmussen. It said that almost a third of Americans worry that we're on the verge of an actual hot, firing, shooting civil war. And you would think, well, this is kind of a silly question and so on, but you see more and more headlines along those lines. There was a column in USA Today from Glenn Reynolds, who's a very well-respected legal analyst. There have been headlines in The Hill and others, publications like the Washington Times, which has said what we're seeing is that not simply that we're dividing, but that we have contempt for one another. And so when you hear things like Maxine Waters encouraging people to harass people who are on the other side of the political aisle, or Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the head of DHS can't go out and have a simple night on the town without being harassed and things of that sort, you're seeing the very beginning of this view that it's not enough simply to oppose one another, but that we have to ruin the lives of other people. And ultimately, that leads to some very dangerous things. We have to embrace an ideological version in the 21st century of our founding creed, e pluribus unum, out of many one. And we can either learn to get along together and, to quote that great poet-philosopher Clint Eastwood, either we're going to live together or we're going to die together.
It's great words, Ben, and important ones, actually, because I think to your point, and we had a guest on yesterday talking about how these things typically don't end without some significant catastrophe or war, and hopefully we can come back from the edge of these hardened positions. Love your voice. Love your wisdom. Thanks for walking us through so much of what's happening in our world today, Ben.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
27 minutes past the hour, we'll take a break for Lighten Up and then the news. And when we come back, Jeremy Dice will actually be joining us again from First Liberty to talk through the Supreme Court. He was on yesterday. So glad to have him back on this morning. You know, Logan, politics aside, whether you agree or disagree with one side or the other, the reality is the reaction from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when it was announced that she was victorious was priceless.
There was no one more surprised than she was. I mean, she couldn't say any words. She was being physically held up by her friends. It's, regardless of what you think of it, it's a pretty entertaining clip to find on YouTube.
It's great stuff. Well, we'll go to the news, and when we come back, we'll speak with Jeremy Dice from First Liberty around some of the Supreme Court implications moving forward, specifically Roe versus Wade. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. Author and president of Cornerstone University, Joe Stowell, talks a bit with us this morning about effective leadership.
Obviously, leaders need to accomplish something. But what we're missing is the fact that it's not just what you do, but it's who you are and how you do it as you accomplish and become successful in whatever enterprise that you're leading. So it's those two elements that I think are very critical and often ignored. And when they're ignored, ultimately as leaders, we end up probably doing more damage than good. At least we have that potential. So the whole thrust of the thesis is who I am, character, as I lead, and then how I lead, how I treat people, the processes are critically important if we are to be really, truly successful leaders. And it's the harder job. I mean, it's easy to skip who I am and how I do what I do and just pull all the levers to become successful and leave body bags all over the place and people don't count. We're just getting the job done. So I think personally, this emphasis is a lacking emphasis, so critical. And at the core of this is the example of the most unlikely leader in history, and that's Jesus Christ and the wisdom of Jesus Christ in developing who we are and how we lead.
That is Joe Stowell, the president of Cornerstone University. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com and search for Joe Stowell or Effective Leadership and get the entirety of his conversation on effective leadership. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined again this morning by Jeremy Dice of First Liberty to talk through some of the implications of the new Supreme Court vacancy.
Would you answer this question? What role does God's Word have in your life? This is Jim Garlow. Oh, we quote the book, we talk about it, but do we fully understand its purpose? Hebrews 4:12 makes an amazing claim. The Word of God is living and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even the dividing of soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart. The Bible judges you and me. We don't judge the Bible. We can't just pick and choose verses we like and discard others we don't. We have to take the whole counsel of God and receive it. Submit to it. Here's the point. As you read and submit to what the Bible says, understanding its purpose, it makes all the difference in your life. Live out your faith. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
It is 22 minutes before the top of the hour. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined on the line again this morning by Jeremy Dice. Jeremy, I walked in this morning and said, we've got to get him back on the line if at all possible, because we needed your perspective on what's going on with the Supreme Court vacancy. But I got to ask first, I'm feeling a bit not sophisticated, I guess would be the right way to say it, with my coffee this morning after you were mentioning your Tropicana tea yesterday. Are you back on the tea train already this morning, Jeremy?
You know, I haven't quite gotten to my morning cup yet, but it'll be very, very soon.
Well, thanks for taking just even a few minutes out of the morning here, unscheduled, but love having you on. And what was your reaction to the news that broke yesterday afternoon about Kennedy retiring?
I think we have to thank Justice Kennedy for his 30-plus years of service to the Supreme Court and 40-some-odd years on the federal bench in total. That's a lot to give up for. That's hard work for any person in this country to do, and I think he deserves that credit. You know, I have full confidence that President Trump has assembled an excellent team of advisors to look for and to find and then nominate the next nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States. You know, if any past indication is an indication of the future, I think the country stands to welcome a good justice to that Supreme Court, whether that's Justice Gorsuch or the several many other judges that have been appointed and finally confirmed to the federal benches at both the circuit court and district court levels around the country. So I think our country stands at a real opportunity moment here. Are we going to go in the direction of Justice Scalia in the past, or where will this take us in the next few months? Of course, that's going to set up a pretty severe and incredible Senate showdown, but this is all part of our Republican democracy.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty bruising, I think, over the next couple of months, because, of course, the Republicans are going to want to get the nominee through before the midterm elections. And where do we see the court going after this in terms of who plays that role of swing vote now moving forward? There's been some indication it could be even the Chief Justice, John Roberts, would move more into that moderate swing vote role. What do you see with that moving forward?
That certainly seems to be the most natural fit. I mean, you've got the four on the left who are rather entrenched in their leftist positions. Justice Kagan, every once in a while, will find a spot on the right-hand side of the bench there. She did in Masterpiece and a couple other places. But, no, I think it is Chief Justice Roberts that seems to have that more centrist kind of mindset and role. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, whoever is appointed next could also play that role further down the line. Let's not forget that Justice Kennedy came into the Supreme Court from President Reagan, and he was the third pick by President Reagan for that one seat that Justice Powell had vacated. And that was Robert Bork was first, and the Senate couldn't confirm him. And then Justice Ginsburg, a different Justice Ginsburg, had to withdraw himself from that nomination. And then it ended up being Anthony Kennedy who became that, as we know, swing vote now. So I think it's something to say what future is going to hold for any individual justice. That's why it's so critical, I think, that President Trump talk with his advisors, make sure he gets the right insight to find someone more in the mold of a Justice Scalia that follows the text of the Constitution and will apply that faithfully on the bench rather than some other options that may be out there.
Well, and I think, Jeremy, that the Republicans, too, believe that in whoever the next nominee is, we might end up with five very reliably conservative judges that will rule almost unanimously each time on the same kind of case. But have we seen historical precedent in the Supreme Court where we really have battle lines between five and four? Do they kind of police themselves and say, hey, we've got to have some bit of moderacy with this? Because you look at Kennedy, he didn't always vote on the conservative side of things.
Yeah, if you go back to the early court, the real early court, Chief Justice Marshall's court, you have almost all unanimous opinions there. There's a remarkable amount of unanimous opinions that came out of that early court. So there is certainly precedent for a one-sided view of the court, and I think in the right direction in many cases with Chief Justice Marshall's court. But there are also famous courts that have been very divided, as ours is today. I think we forget oftentimes that these are human beings that are sitting on this bench. They're not gods. They're certainly not with infinite wisdom up there. They're men and women doing the best that they know how to do as attorneys to interpret the Constitution faithfully. Some come to that with a worldview that is predisposed one way. Others have a judicial philosophy that goes a different direction. But at the end of the day, they still they get up in the morning, they have their cup of coffee or perhaps tea, and go into work trying to do the best job that they possibly can under the circumstances.
This is Jeremy Dice, who is graciously joining us for a few minutes here on short notice. He's the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty. And Jeremy, of course, Roe versus Wade was one of the first things that came up as the possibility of looking back at this and going and bringing it before the court again. But it's not as simple as somebody like you or me just stepping into the Supreme Court and saying, hey, let's revisit this decision. What's the process that would even be possible to revisit that decision again in front of the court?
It's going to be significant. It's going to take a lot of effort to make that happen. First, it has to be the right nominee, and it has to be the right justice that will get to that position. As someone that does have a more textualist view in the line of Justice Thomas and perhaps Justice Gorsuch and Alito and the late Justice Scalia. But, it's going to take time for that to occur as well. That these lawsuits have to be brought. They have to work their way through the district court levels, the circuit court levels. There are 500,000 cases brought every year in the federal court system, and only about 80 make it to the Supreme Court of the United States every year. So the chances are very narrow for those kinds of cases to go forward. Not impossible, but they also have to be the right cases. There's this great saying in the law that says bad facts make bad law. There needs to be the right case that is brought there, too. So it's certainly enough. But let's not forget what happens if Roe v. Wade is overturned. What that merely does is return it to a democratic process. Are we going to support abortion or not? Now, I think that's probably an appropriate position to be. Whenever we can hand this back to the people, that's a good thing to be doing. But it doesn't end the practice immediately. It just merely says the people of the United States get to choose how that will be ruled.
Well, my understanding is it would, like you said, just flip it back to the states to decide whether or not their state is going to be pro-abortion or not. Does that have the potential of even further hardening some of the segmentation in our culture, some of the battle lines where you could maybe go to Pennsylvania and abortion would be illegal, but then you head over to New Jersey and we see that it's legal all the way through up until birth? Is this maybe the potential of that?
It's hard to imagine something more uncivil than what we currently find ourselves at right now.
Yeah.
But what I will say is what it does do, it goes to that principle of subsidiarity, meaning that the smallest unit governs best. And so rather than the federal government, this massive behemoth making the decisions up there in Washington or even the federal courts doing that across the country, what it does is it allows something more close to home to state lawmakers that we may see in the grocery store on a given weekend that we can remind them of our positions of this issue. It brings it back into the local community. And I think that's ultimately a very good thing for our country.
And Jeremy, I know you're always working on cases at First Liberty. And again, we talked about your website yesterday and just really fun to see the different cases that are in front of you that you're arguing. Are there cases that you see in your own pipeline that if they made it all the way to the Supreme Court, that there'd be some implications for where you're headed?
Well, we just filed two this Monday at the Supreme Court of the United States, one involving the Blaine'sburg Memorial, as we talked about, and Coach Joe Kennedy that we talked about. That's going to be considered now either by the eight justices of the Supreme Court left when Justice Kennedy retires on July 31st, or by the nine justices when the new justice is nominated and confirmed by this fall, as Senator McConnell says will be the case. So that will be very dependent upon that. But, of course, we've got a case of the 11th Circuit involving a Christian school in Florida that was asked, they wanted to pray before their game over the loudspeaker at the state football championship game. We're told they couldn't do that. That implication could go to the Supreme Court of the United States very easily, and there are dozens of others that are lower than that that have their opportunity to make their way up through the courts as well.
It's Jeremy Nice of First Liberty. Jeremy, just one more question back to the abortion conversation again, too. How much Justice Roberts has come out and said that the idea of revisiting a law that has become so hardened in our country and may disrupt people's lives by changing it in the moment, how much does sort of historical precedent and collective consciousness and how people are thinking about things already, how much does that weigh on any of these decisions, even the union dues decision yesterday? What kind of weight does the Supreme Court put on existing law and the disruption on people's lives?
Well, it certainly puts a lot of weight on past precedent. That we call it precedent for a reason, that we build upon the law as we go down through history. But that doesn't mean that those are set in stone. They're able to be changed. In fact, you just saw that yesterday in the Janus decision, the public labor union's decision that you're talking about. The Supreme Court overruled a decision called Abood from several years ago that had upheld that right. And so it certainly can be changed. The Supreme Court always tries to act in as narrow a manner as possible unless there are no other ways to go about it and have to act broadly like that. So it just depends on what facts come before the court, what arguments are made, and how the justices are inclined to review the law and make a decision.
It's Jeremy Nice. Thanks for taking some time this morning. Jeremy, I'll let you get to your tea. Is it loose leaf tea this morning, or is it a tea bag? Like, how sophisticated do you roll with this tea thing?
I'll go either way, but I do prefer the loose leaf teas.
You do. That is the highest class of tea. Jeremy, it just speaks to your credibility on all things in this moment. Thanks for joining us this morning on short notice.
Thanks much.
It's 11 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up this first hour of the show. It is 9 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. And of course, Logan, so much in the headlines. We've just been a packed first hour on that. I would love you. I understand you're millennial, if I've got this right.
That sounds right.
Do I know my generations? When does the millennial thing cut off? Do you have any idea?
It's actually under debate.
It is.
Some people
so
say...
So another thing that has to be controversial. We just can't come to an agreement as a culture on this.
Exactly. Some people say it's at the year 2000. Others say it's right as computers like really launched at 90, I think it's 7.
So you have a bit of identity confusion going on. Do you kind of flip back and forth between the generations?
All I know is I'm about as young as I can possibly be to fit into the millennial side.
That's perfect. Well, I would be curious your reaction, obviously, from your angle, when there's a woman out of New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is only 6 years older than you, and she's going to most likely be the youngest serving woman in history in the House of Representatives. And there are some things that are pretty compelling as you watch the headlines for you, even related to fundraising in this situation.
I can pretty much tell you exactly why I think she got elected. I mean, it's at this point not surprising because of the platform that she stood on, as opposed to the person who everyone expected to take it no problem, Crowley. I mean, fundraising wise, when I talk about millennials, when we talk about the youth, we want people who are authentic. And that's a big problem with politicians, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't feel a lot of truth being sent our way. I mean, you know how everybody feels about politicians and lawyers. It's not great. So when she went out and did fundraising, she was committed to, I'm not going to take corporate money. I'm not going to do anything like this. I'm going to get around to small businesses and donations like that. And she only raised $300,000 for a New York City primary, which compare that to Crowley's fundraising of $3 million. It's surprising that anyone even heard she was running in the first place.
Absolutely. It was special interest money. It was the typical way that politicians would raise funds in Crowley and being this 10-term incumbent. This was really a shocking upset, but it is representative to some degree as sort of the momentum that we saw among some in the 2016 elections with Bernie Sanders. It almost didn't really matter as much what the platforms were. I mean, I don't think anybody sees sort of free tuition as a really easy thing to implement in our culture, or socialized medicine for all. It feels like there's this anger about the corruption that is driving the conversation. So you see this young woman raise $300,000 and win an election. That's incredibly compelling.
That is still, yes, it's a head-jerk reaction from two years ago, because actually her only experience in politics is help setting up Bernie Sanders campaign rallies.
Fascinating.
That is her only experience in the political sphere. And like you were saying, this is something that young people are still very upset about, is how that whole Democratic Party Bernie Sanders thing went down. And it's something that she really embraced. She said to herself, I'm just a person. You know, my mom is from Puerto Rico. My dad is born right here in New York City. I don't have any money. Usually politics is all about who you're born into. And this, I was not born into that. I'm just a person that lives here. Crowley, he doesn't live here. He doesn't drink our water. He doesn't breathe our air. She made this video that went completely viral. And she said to herself, I'm a person. He is part of the institution. And that is what people are fed up with, because the institution didn't give Bernie a fair chance. And it put Hillary Clinton in the spotlight. And I don't know anyone that was thrilled about Hillary Clinton. I mean, even the Democrats were saying, she's not great. I mean, you know, this election that we went into, nobody was really thrilled about either side. But Hillary Clinton was not the people's first choice, yeah, especially the younger ages. So this is still a reaction to that, and saying, I'm upset that this institution that I kind of agree with their ideals, or at least the left is saying, I agree with their ideals, but I hate the way they're running things. And she is an exact example of trying to change how things are being run in this institution.
Yeah, and it was interesting. You know, so many of our guests, too, well, they advocate for religious liberty, religious freedom. We saw that with Ben Johnson. Love him as our first guest, and he articulated the importance of freedom and capitalism. But I don't know how much that message these days is appealing to the millennial generation, where you see nearly 40% of millennials would at least support on some level ideas of socialism. Is that what you're seeing among some of your friends as well?
You know, that embrace itself is there. It is absolutely there. I know some people who think at least some ideals of socialism are okay. But one thing it's important to remember about how polarized our country has become is that there are more moderate people than you think. There are so many people who are really just down the middle who say, yeah, you know, I'm not a big fan of Trump, but yeah, I'll vote for him. The problem is that's not exciting.
Right.
That doesn't get on the news. That
no
doesn't
clicks
go
for
viral.
That one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
People want to see screaming banners. They want to see people jumping from the windows, shouting their politician's name. That's what gets on the news. And those people are so much more passionate about their extreme views that they're much louder and much more present. So when we see these incredibly socialist people or these incredibly alt-right people, they're there. But they're nowhere as large as the moderate community. So I think it's much more focused around her ideals and who she is as a person and what she ran on rather than her socialist beliefs. But it is there. That is absolutely a justified part of why some people would have voted for her.
Yeah, well said. I've often said that, you know, it doesn't ever make the news each day that 30 million children played safely on the monkey bars that day. It's always the news that if one fell off and then we change all of our playground policy because of the extremities. Those are the things that make the news. Great comments on the need for moderacy and our government. Let's take a short break. We'll wrap up our first hour. It's Faith Radio Mornings. Great first hour with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute and Jeremy Dice joining us on short notice. And Logan, that was passionate and articulate. I mean, you are breaking down the generalizations that millennials just want to sit in the basement eating Cheetos and playing video games.
To be fair, that is exactly what I want.
Okay.
I just know that I can't do it to survive in the world.
Love it. Well, crunchy or puffy Cheeto guy for you?
Actually, do you know about Twisted Cheetos?
I don't know about Twisted Cheetos.
They've gone away. They're only found in the most remote gas stations of North Dakota for some reason, but they're puffy in large twists. They're the best thing in the world.
Oh, some of our listeners from the Fargo affiliate, please send us a package of Twisted Cheetos. We'll take a break for the top of the hour, and Logan and I are introducing a new segment into the show called Super Sunday School. Stay with us for the next hour.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.